All right, first of all, I wanted to give you an idea of why I even started this. So while this is aimed more at the teenagers and the young adults, this is something that we all can benefit from. When I was in eighth grade, and it might have been ninth, in fact, I think it was ninth grade, an event happened that helped kind of seal this for me. I had, as happens, now you get a piece of paper that you usually take to your principal saying, I need off for the Feast of Tabernacles, and they kind of handle it from there. When I was going to school, I had to take a copy of that letter to each of my instructors. So I had seven or eight copies of that. One of my instructors was my science teacher, who was an atheist and an evolutionist. And while he let me off, he didn't have a choice. When I came back from the Feast of Tabernacles, he had set it up in his mind that he wanted to shame me into being someone that believed in a God, because only stupid people believe in God. So when I came back, he made it a point. I mean, every time something would come up, he would say, and this evolved into, and then he would say, and he'd kind of look over my direction and say, now for those people that foolishly think there's a God, I mean, how dumb can you be, right? And I spent the next couple of months being bullied by a science teacher. Now, you may or may not have that happen, but it can. If you go to universities now, if you go to many schools where they're teaching science, they teach evolution as a fact and religion as a fake. So what I wanted to do today was go through a creation apology. Now, what do I mean by apology? That actually has two meanings. One meaning is you're sorry that you believe in something. That is not how I intend this. If you read in the Bible, I think it's in the early chapters, Acts chapter 6, Acts chapter 8, somewhere in there, where Stephen gave his apology for believing in Christ. An apology is a defense of what you believe, a justification for why you believe. So what I want to do today is I want to go through a justification for why I believe in creation over evolution. And the reason behind this is to be able to give some of you, if you need this, information or leverage, if you want to say. We're going to go through and we're going to talk about several aspects of creations, several aspects of evolution. And what I want to do is just to be able to give you some fodder so that if it happens where you need to defend your faith or your belief, you at least have some idea of where to start. It's a very interesting conversation to have if you have ever had a conversation with someone who is agnostic. That's one thing. That's I'm not sure what I believe, but probably not. That's different than atheistic, where they are militantly atheistic. Now, the other side of that coin can also be true. You can have a militantly religious person that tries to force their opinion on someone that doesn't believe in God as well. Equally as wrong. So I want to tell you what kind of started this. It reminded me of what happened to me in ninth grade. A guy came along by the name of Louis Nye, the science guy. Now, do anybody know who he is? He's actually a very smart, very intelligent man. He's this guy, he always wears a bow tie. No offense to him, but he always kind of looks like a nerd or like a Mr. Rogers neighborhood or whatever. But he has started to say some things that are anti-religion. Now, he's stayed away from that in the past, but it has become more and more popular lately. And I actually wanted to read a couple of quotes from him. This is Louis Nye, Bill Nye. Who was Louis Nye? He was a comedian, wasn't he? Yeah, anyway. Bill Nye. If you want to exercise organized religion, knock yourselves out, right? If you want to go do that, fine. If you get comfort from it, if it enriches your life, you've got that community. That's fine. But the Bible is not a scientific textbook. Now, I'm going to spend some time talking about today. That I actually agree with that statement. It's not. It's not a science textbook, right? You don't use the Bible to figure out how atoms are made. That's not what it's for. He goes on to say, the earth is not 6,000 or 10,000 years old. It's not. And if that conflicts with your beliefs, I strongly feel you should question your beliefs. Now, we're going to talk about this whole 6,000-year thing, too. If we raise a generation of students who don't believe in the process of science, who think that everything we've come to know about nature and the universe can be dismissed by a few sentences translated into English from some ancient text, what book do you think he's talking about? About the Bible. Is he talking about the Quran? No. Is he talking about Hindu literature? No. Is he talking about Greek mythology? No. He's talking about the Hebrew Bible. If you think it can be dismissed by a few sentences translated into English from some ancient text, then we're not going to continue to innovate. We're just going to all fall into to this massless jelly of stupid people that think that that it's just God and we can dismiss everything else. Most educated people in the United States, and I mean most, have a lot of science background. There are some that believe in a creator. There are some that don't. The ones that don't believe in a creator tend to be more vocal. So when you look at education today, it tends to lean toward a belief in evolution. Evolution says, and these are there are two figures here that I'm going to use throughout this presentation. So they're important to note. Evolution says that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. I'm fine. I actually have no problem with that. The Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and the universe is 13.7 billion years old. And I have no problem with that. We'll talk about those two. Those two figures are going to be very important as we go through that. But some, I couldn't even say much, but some of Christianity teaches that the entire universe is only 6,000 years old. Why? And we're going to talk about why some religions teach that everything is 6,000 years old. It's called young earth creationism. Some say there's a happy middle ground. What does the Bible say, and who's right? So I'm going to spend some time talking about this today. And we'll Bill Nye's comments will come up from time to time in this, because I think what he says is important, but we need to understand it in context. There's a couple of scriptures that are going to be very important. We're going to come back to them time and time again. One of them is Romans 1 in verse 20, and it states this: since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. So what does that mean? Parse through these words, and it says, you can believe in the creation because you can look at the creation and recognize that there had to have been a creator behind it. We'll spend some time talking about that today. But it's interesting when you look at this, because this makes an assumption. This makes an assumption that if I look at this lectern and it's made out of wood, someone had to have made the processes that will bring a tree into place. A tree can't develop on its own. Evolution says it can. Religious science says it can. If you can't touch or see something, I'm talking about God. How many of you have ever seen God? He's come down in physical form, knocked on your door, and said, hi, I'm God. Right? There's no hands going up. So if you can't, and if you have never seen God, how do you know God exists? According to Romans 1:20, you know he exists because of what he made. Okay? But what if there wasn't a God? What if it did evolve? And that sometimes gets thrown into the minds of people when they go to school and they come to church and they've got two different stories that they're being told. And evolution can sound very, very real, very factual. We'll talk about that today. If there is another way to explain how this wood came into being, then maybe there isn't a God. So what's right? That's what we'll discuss today. I put three books up here. These are three books that come at this from a different perspective. This first one is Cambridge University uses the Encyclopedia of Human Evolution. Notice the picture. It's almost a Photoshop of a person and an ape, right? So the idea behind this is they presented, actually it almost looks like Johnny Carson to me. If I look at that really closely, I can see, can you see it? I'm sorry to Mr. Carson, he's not alive anymore, but when I look at this picture, you recognize what they're trying to do. This is a scientific textbook with a made-up picture on the front. All right, let's just keep that in the back of your minds. The middle book, I actually have read this book, it's called In 6 Days. These are 50 scientists, PhDs, that believe that the Earth is only 6,000 years old. That God, when God created Adam and Eve, that's when he created everything. Earth, moon, all the galaxies, it all appears like it's old. So you might look at, give you an example. There's a the Andromeda Galaxy, and I don't know how far away it is, but the light from the Andromeda Galaxy would have taken millions of years to get here. So to an evolutionist, it was created millions of years ago, and it's taken that long for the light to get here. To a young Earth creationist, God made the Andromeda Galaxy, made the light rays so that it looks millions of years old, but it's actually only 6,000 years old, and he created the appearance of age. So those are the people in the middle. And often the people on the left and the people in the middle are the ones that really are battling each other. Bill Nye would say it is foolish to think that the Earth is 6,000 years old. It is obviously older than that. A creationist would say, no, I have an intelligent God, and he created it to look old. Then you've got the third people, and this is called the Battle of the Beginnings. This is an example of one of their textbooks, where they believe that what you've got is pretty much like what you see on the news today. We actually turned the news on today just to watch it before I came to see if there was anything going on. And I can only watch the news now for about 30 seconds, and I have to turn it off, because here's how the news works. They introduce a subject, they've got a pro and a con, and they leave both microphones on so that after they introduce it, they just start arguing with each other, and they try and talk over each other, and then I have to shut the television off because I really like my television, and I would throw something at it if I left it on. The whole idea behind science and evolution is neither one is going to convince the other, but they're going to try and convince the other, and it ends up just being a big argument. Evolution is taught as an absolute in most schools now. Now we're going to talk about whether or not science is an absolute. Some science is an absolute. We'll show some of this. But there are others that insist that both science and creation can coexist. I do agree, as I said earlier, with Bill Nye on one vital point. The Bible was never intended to be a scientific textbook. If you try and figure out how an atom is put together, you will not find the answer to that in the Bible. But what the Bible is a book of origin. It says where things came from. It doesn't say how, but it says where. And if you look at the Bible as not as a science textbook, but as a book of origins, then you can start to put some sense to this. In the middle of this, we've got the Bible. Now, I specifically put it on an iPad, just to kind of bring it into 21st century. The Bible, to me, isn't an ancient text written on a scroll. You know, I pull my old Bible out, and I open it up, and I smell dust. You know what I'm saying? I mean, books sometimes can seem very old. Is the Bible so old and so out of date that it isn't useful today? This is what we're going to talk about today. I put a picture up here. This is the Large Hadron Collider near Geneva, Switzerland. This is in the CERN laboratory. If you've ever seen what they're doing with this, they will take atoms and they'll spin them at almost the speed of light, one going one way, one going the other. And then at a certain point when they're at or near the speed of light, they bring them together so that these two atoms will collide. And then as they collide and as quarks and things kind of explode off of this, they look at what they would consider to be a kind of a miniature version of what the Big Bang would have been like. And from there, they start to deduce things. And it's actually very interesting. They've discovered a lot of stuff at the subatomic level that's actually very exciting. But I want to go through something today, and for those of you that have ever looked at this before, I want to talk about this because it becomes important with this topic of evolution versus creation. For you kids that have to go through this, and even you parents that have to go through this, there is a scientific method that science uses to prove something. It's very specific, it's very direct, and it's extremely well-written. This is really good. How many of you have ever had to do a science project where you had a trifold like a cardboard thing where you have to do that? Most parents, at least some of the older parents, would have had to have done this. We did with our kids, where the kids have to come up with some science project that they want to do, and they come up with a hypothesis. And then they have to try and figure out what they think is going to happen. And then they do an experiment to either prove or disprove what they think is going to happen and then come up with a conclusion. That's the scientific method, and there are four parts to that. You have to observe the phenomena, so you set up your experiment and you observe it. You have to then formulate what you think is going to happen. So here's an example of one. I mean, this one girl did it. It was a really neat experiment. She took two plants and then she took water, and in one she boiled the water on the stove, and on another, she heated the water to boiling in the microwave, then cooled both pots of water down, and then watered one plant from the stove water and one plant from the microwave. And that was what she did. Come to find out, the plant that had the microwaved water died. The plant that had the water that wasn't nuked to death survived. So she came up with this theory of maybe there's something that happens to water from microwave versus stove, and it won her some money. And some scientists looked at that and thought, maybe we need to look a little closer at this. That is, you observe something and you think, I think this is what's going to happen. In this case, she said, I wonder if microwave water is bad for plants. Then you do an experiment to determine whether it's true or false, and then from the data, you make a conclusion. Now, let's talk a little bit about evolution versus creation. If you apply this scientific method, which is what science would tell you you need to do to prove something is right or wrong, you cannot use the scientific method to prove creation, and you cannot use the scientific method to prove evolution. Why? Look at what you have to do. You have to observe the phenomena. How long does it take for evolution to occur? Millions and billions of years. How long do you live? 80 if you're lucky. You cannot observe evolution. Therefore, you can't scientifically discuss it. You have to formulate a hypothesis. Now, you can certainly do that. But then, how are you going to do an experiment to prove whether evolution or creation is true? You can't do it. Can you create something? Are you God? No, you can't scientifically prove that God created everything, nor can you scientifically prove, using the scientific method, that evolution is correct. You simply don't have the data to be able to do it. What I want to come as a conclusion today and help you understand is creation, your belief in God, is faith. It is not something that you can prove scientifically. It is faith. We'll see that in Scripture. But I also want to tell you that a belief in evolution is faith. It is not science, and it is not fact. It is faith. And if you're really careful and you read what scientists say about evolution, you will recognize even what they call it. It is the theory of evolution. But it's presented as the fact of evolution. We'll go through that as we talk today. I want to talk about circular reasoning, and then I want to show you an example of this. What is circular reasoning? We use that term a lot, but it actually is quite specific. Circular reasoning is you assume that something is true that you're trying to prove. All right? I'm a detective, and I think that Tom Letier committed some heist, and he stole some jewels, and I am so convinced of it that I'm going to prove him wrong. That's circular reasoning. Right, I'm not trying to be unbiased and find the facts. I'm just trying to find that my conclusion is true. That's circular reasoning. But another thing that's really interesting in circular reasoning is that you support a premise with a premise instead of supporting a premise from a conclusion. I want to give you a couple of examples of that. I saw in a science textbook once, it was very interesting. They found some dinosaur bones, and they asked the question, the teacher asked the question, how old are these bones? And here was his conclusion. Since we found these bones in this layer of dirt, and we assume that this layer of dirt is from the Triassic period, therefore the bones are from the Triassic period. All right, now do you hear all those words in there? We assume this level of dirt was Triassic. The bones were there, therefore, they're drawing a conclusion from a premise. I'll show you a picture in a moment of how you can disprove this, but I think it's interesting. But the Bible, the creationists can do the same thing. You can read in the book of Genesis and say, you know, Adam was so old when he had Enos, and Enos was so old when he had, you know, Cain and Mahalalel and all the, and you can add all those up and come up to 6,000 years. Therefore, since the Bible says that Adam was created 6,000 years ago, the universe was created 6,000 years ago. That is circular reasoning. It's basing a premise on a premise, not a premise on a conclusion. Both science and religion are guilty of this. I want to show you an example in case you ever need to explain to someone. This is an example of one. This is called a polystrate tree. All right, now, and I should have brought my little lighty thing. If you've got one, bring it up to me. If you look at this, ignore the tree for a moment. Just assume that I cropped the tree out. If I look at that layer of strata, science would tell you that that layer of strata probably took hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years, to lay down. And you can go 4 or 5 feet down and be hundreds of thousands of years back. You can go 6 or 7 feet down and be millions of years back. And yet, if you look right beside it, there is a tree that obviously started growing at the bottom where that little pickaxe is. It's kind of hard to see. You can even see some root structures there. And it grew throughout this strata that was supposedly took hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years to lay down. And yet a tree grows and dies in a matter of, 900 to 1,000 years, if you're lucky. There are a few trees in Israel that are 2,000 to 3,000 years old. Probably some of the red oaks and others that are in California, maybe a few thousand years old. But they're not hundreds of thousands of years old, and they're not millions of years old. So if you put the two of these side by side, just because a bone ends up in 8 feet down does not mean it's millions of years old. It's circular reasoning. Obviously, this tree grew, and all of the rock and stuff got layered down here in a much narrower time frame than hundreds of thousands or millions of years. So one of the things, again, and the point of bringing this out is, just because a scientist says to you, it's 6 feet down, therefore it's X amount of thousands of millions of years old, that is their assumption based on the fact that, bones are found there, and we know the bones are dinosaurs, and dinosaurs lived a long time ago because they're in this layer, but the layer is there because we know the bones were there. They're using circular reasoning to try and date things. It's very bad. There are scientists now today that will even tell you that carbon dating has some serious flaws in, you can carbon date something that is just a few hundred or a few thousand years old and be pretty accurate. But if you go back tens of thousands or longer years, then carbon dating can and often does have some issues with it. So as we look through this today, what I want to again kind of reiterate to you is, both religion and science can have this same thing where we come up and use circular reasoning to try and determine what our belief is. But in the end, what is it? It's our belief based on things that we see, based on things that scientists see who don't believe in God. This is a belief and not a fact. This is one of the other main scriptures that I want to use today. There are people, even maybe some of you in the audience, want to charge up to me afterwards and say, no, the creation is a fact, is a provable fact. And I would tell you the Bible disagrees with you, if that's what you believe. Hebrews 11, verse 3, notice what this says. By faith, we understand that the universe was created by the word of God. It is not a fact that you can prove scientifically. It is a faith. You believe that God created the world. I believe that God created the earth and the universe. But Hebrews 11, 3 says it is by faith that we believe that. It is a faith-based belief. So that what is seen is not made out of things that are invisible. The problem with a lot of science is they present it as if it's a fact, when in fact it's an opinion, if you'll pardon my pun. But what we can do is we can use the scientific method. You question something, you form a hypothesis, you look at data, and you draw a conclusion. I want to go through some things from science today that would point toward a creator and away from evolution. Now, I'm not saying that what I want to show you today is absolute proof of something, but I'm telling you in school, young people, you will be presented with evolution as an absolute fact. And in fact, it's someone who has done some research and using, in a lot of cases, circular reasoning, have come up to a conclusion that is not based scientifically. In the end, Hebrews 11, verse 3 is something that we need to remember. We believe in a creator by faith. We have never seen God. We did not watch him go through the creation process. Simply haven't. It is faith. This is a faith-based belief. Put a picture up here of the Big Bang. Not the Big Bang Theory. You're not going to see Sheldon and Penny and anybody up here. This is different. This is the Big Bang. The idea here, again, is the universe came into existence with a bang. So everything, all of the matter and on all of that was in this really tight space, and it exploded. And that happened 13.7 billion years ago. That's the latest estimate. That changes, and that's fine. So, and then it is speculated that 4.5 billion years ago, or somewhere right in this area, the Earth would have formed. So you've got all these atoms, all the dust that have gone out, and then it starts to coalesce. And as you know, anything that's matter, even two atoms, there's mass there, and they're going to be attracted, and they start to form. And now you get suns, and then you get the Earth, etc. So evolution would tell you that 13.7 billion years ago, an explosion occurred. And again, I really have no problem with that. We weren't there to watch how God made it, but this could have been how he started the process. We don't know. And that 4.5 billion years ago was when the Earth coalesced. Now, creationism has several viewpoints. Now, I want to kind of talk through these. There's three of them out there. One is what we would call the young Earth creationism that says that God created everything 6,000 years ago to look old. Right? That's one point of view. A second point of view is that God created the universe billions of years ago, but he created man 6,000 years ago, and that often is called the gap theory. You may have seen that in even some of our church literature, the gap theory. Then there is another one called theistic evolution, and what that believes is God created all of the material, put it into this infinitely tiny space, let it blow up, and then he just stepped back and watched it evolve. All right? So you've got evolution that would say God was never involved. A theistic evolution would say, where'd you get the matter for the Big Bang? I say God created the matter and then just sit back and watched it, and over the last 13.7 billion years it evolved. And he's been watching it. Oh, look, we got man that came out of this. How cool is that? I'll start working with him. Right? That's theistic evolution. What I want to do through... Thank you. Which button is it? The orange one. I can't miss the orange one, right? How about if I turn it the right way? Don't laugh at that. Okay. What has the church traditionally taught? Now, the reason why I want to go through this is because there are... I've been challenged on this in the past, not only through science teachers, but also through people that have been in the church, young adults. I know one young adult in the Dallas area got his PhD in marine biology. He's a very intelligent young man. And he has seen evidence of microevolution. Birds that are in an isolated area that grow a different color feather, or the feather size changes based on their environment. I've got no problem with that. God creates things with the ability to adapt. But there's no evidence of a macroevolution where one species can become another. There was an episode of Star Trek once where everybody devolved, and I can't remember who all it was, but Worf became a reptile, and somebody else became a lemur, and they devolved back into different species. What does the church, and what has the church traditionally taught about the various theories of creationism? I want to go through several scriptures, kind of one after another, that helps draw the picture. I apologize. I know people don't like seeing pictures of angels or pictures of God or whatever, but I wanted to put something up for everybody to be able to look at. So the first scripture I want to go through is Job chapter 38, verses 4 through 7. Because this, again, the Bible is a book of origins. And if you put scripture upon scripture, you can start to draw a timeline. So let's do that. This is God talking to Job. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? What does that tell you? God was obviously there before the foundations of the earth. We're going to start setting up what came first. Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined the measurements of the earth? Surely you know. Who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? So when the earth was created, we know that the angels were already there. The angelic realm was created prior to the creation of the earth. How far? How long? How did it happen? How'd you put it all together? It's not a science textbook. It's a book of origins. God was there first, The angels were there second. The earth came after that. So we know that the angels were there first. Ezekiel chapter 28. This is one of my favorite pictures. I know, again, you look at God and he's old and he's got gray hair and a gray beard and all that. But the part of this picture that I like is a rebellious Lucifer. You see him sitting there. He's got his hands, you can just see the attitude. Any of you that have ever had a teenager has seen this pose. You know, they're in opposition and they're ready to fight you at every bit. Ezekiel 28, verses 15 and 16. Talking about Lucifer. You were perfect in the ways from the day you were created. So we know that angels, according to the Bible, according to this book of origins, were created until iniquity was found in you. By the abundance of your trading, you became, didn't start out that way, filled with violence, and you sinned. Therefore, I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed, and the Hebrew word there, it's a very poor translation. It means I banished you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones. So we know that he was at the throne of God. We know that he was perfect when he was created. But we know that somewhere down the road, he sinned, and as a result, he was banished from heaven. Where did he go? Where did God send him? Luke chapter 10, verse 18, this is Jesus Christ saying, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven to earth. We know that Satan is here on the earth. We know that by putting these scriptures together, the angels were created first, including Lucifer. Lucifer sinned somewhere along the way. Lucifer came to earth. This earth had been created by God. He had come to earth, and that as a result of his being cast away from heaven, he was sent to earth. Now, let's look at a couple of more things, and we'll draw an even closer picture. How was the earth created? Was the earth created beautiful, or was the earth created in chaos? Isaiah 45, verse 18. For thus says the Eternal who created the heavens. Remember, we're talking, this is a book of origin. God created the heavens and the earth. Who is God who formed the earth and made it and established it, and he did not create it in vain? This word for vain is the Hebrew word tohu. And I probably am pronouncing that wrong. Anybody that knows anything about Hebrew would probably laugh at that. But the church has tended to pronounce it tohu. So I'll say it that way just because that sounds familiar. So it says that it was God who created the heavens. This says that God created the earth. And it says that when he created it, he did not create it tohu. So we know that when the earth was created, it was not created tohu. Now let's go back to Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. And this is where we come into what the church would call and scoffers would call the gap theory. Chapter 1, verse 1 says the same thing. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. This word created, bara, is an initial creation. This is when it was first came into being. But notice what verse 2 says. It says the earth was without form. If you look at the Hebrew words, was is haya, and it means that it became. It didn't start out that way, but it became without form. And that word without form is the same Hebrew word that we saw in Isaiah, tohu. So Isaiah, whatever it was, 45, is it Isaiah 45? I don't have my notes in front of me. Isaiah 45 says God didn't create the earth tohu, but Genesis 1 verse 2 says that the earth became tohu. So it wasn't created that way, but it became that way. So what happened between verse 1, when God created the heavens and the earth beautifully, and verse 2 where it says it became waste? It became without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. So if you look at this from a kind of a time point of view, if the earth wasn't created that way, but it became that way, and if you look at the fact that Lucifer was banished from heaven to earth, could it be that in his anger, he destroyed the face of the earth and he allowed it to decay? What does Satan want right now? Does Satan want for you to be in the kingdom of God? The answer is absolutely not. He wants you to die and everything with it. That is not what Satan wants. The church has taught over the years that there was a time gap between verse 1 and verse 2. The majority of the people, I'm not saying everyone, the majority of the people in the church believe that the earth and the universe were created before it became tohu. Now, how long? A year? 100 years? 1,000 years? 1,000,000 years? Doesn't say. This isn't, again, a scientific textbook. This is just a book of origins that kind of puts things in order. It was created perfect. It was messed up. And God had to come back and re-fix everything. We're going to read a scripture about that in just a minute. So it certainly appears that there was at least some time gap between when the angel shouted for joy and it becoming without form and void and darkness on the face of the deep. You can't imagine the angel shouting for joy at a dark, chaotic mess. No, this was something that happened later. So the church, again, has speculated that this may have been, this pre-Adamic world may have been the world of dinosaurs. Obviously, dinosaurs did exist. Obviously, they're very old. One of the puzzles that I have, and if you ever have a chance to look at this, I would encourage you to. There is a place in near Dallas called Dinosaur National Park. Has anybody actually ever been there? We had someone in the Laurel Church that had actually gone. There are footprints of dinosaur and human footprints side by side in the same mud that happened at the same time and then solidified into stone over a period of time. So to say that dinosaurs and humanity did not exist side by side is not true. I'm saying that there were dinosaurs and humanoids that existed at the same time. Now, is that a few thousand years ago? I don't know. I want to look at Genesis 1:1, and I want to give you, and this is in all caps, my speculation. Do I have to be any more clear than that? Nobody call Mr. Horchek and say that I'm... This is me. I have no problem with dinosaurs having lived millions of years ago. But Genesis chapter 1 and chapter 2 tell me that 6,000 years ago, God created human beings and placed the spirit of man in them. That to me is my belief system. To me, that's an absolute. But I don't have any problem with humanoids having lived prior to Adam. I just think that at some point it all got wiped out, and when God came back 6,000 years ago and reinvented things, he may have put humanoids back on Earth and gave them the human spirit, and that started at Adam. There could have been something like pre-Adamic man. I don't know. But it's different than saying that God created the universe 13.7 billion years ago and just let it evolve. I don't believe that for a second. So let's go on and let's look at something that Psalm 104 verse 30 says, because this lets us know how God works. You send forth your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the earth. Now this isn't the original creation. This is talking about what God can do with his spirit. We know what happened once before, around 6,000 years ago, when God renewed. The earth had become without form and void, and all of a sudden, 7 days later, it was a beautiful thing. We know it's going to happen again. When Jesus Christ returns with his saints, what's he going to do? He's going to renew the earth. He's going to beautify it again. He did it once before. He's going to do it again. So if we look at Genesis chapter 2 in verse 1, this is after the 6 days of creation. It says, thus the heavens and the earth and all of the host of them were finished. So again, how long between the creation of the earth and the renewal of the earth? We don't know. But we know there was at least some gap or some span of time between those two events. Now, what I want to do is I want to give, for those of you that wonder about this sometimes, and the scientific method will try and promote things to you, I want to go through 3 or 4 data points today that come from science that talk about evolution. And I want to use those same facts to let you be able to show you that it is not an absolute fact, but it is, in fact, a belief. And I want to talk about the laws of thermodynamics, one of the data points in the discussion. If you ever look at this, and if you ever study this in school, I did. When I first studied this, I was in 10th grade. I was in physics class, and we talked about the laws of thermodynamics. There are two very important laws. Here's the first law of thermodynamics. If you want to talk to a scientist, talk to them in their language. Talk to them about the laws of thermodynamics. Here's the first law. Energy can be changed from one form to another, but it can't be created. The laws of thermodynamics say that the only energy that we have in the universe was not something that was created or invented. In other words, they say that there's not a God that started it, but somehow all this energy was already here. And through that energy, you can have mass, you can have the universe, you can have laws, etc. But it says that energy can't be created. So it kind of goes back to the old joke where God says to the scientists, you and I are going to have an experiment and we're going to make a man. And the guy says, great. And he starts to pull up the dirt. And God says, no, you have to bring your own dirt. Right? The energy cannot be created. So that is a law in thermodynamics. I would ask the question, where did the energy come from? There has to have been some intelligent cause back there to put energy in. The total amount of energy and matter in the universe remains constant. It merely changes from one form to another. That's the first law. The second is even more important. Now, this gets a little technical, but it's very important to understand. Given enough time, our universe will come to equilibrium. When any work is done, there is always dissipation or loss of useful energy. That means for a closed system, which our universe is, the measure of energy no longer available for useful work is increasing. According to evolution, given enough time, it will evolve from something lower to something greater. In other words, the energy that's being used during creation or during evolution creates something that is better, something that is higher formed. The second law of thermodynamics says the absolute opposite. If you start, you have those balls that are on the chains and you start one, it goes tink, 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 tink. It's going to wear down because the energy, as one ball hits another, most of the energy dissipates into the other balls, but some of it is lost into space. Given enough time, the universe is going to run down. It's like a watch that you start and you set there and the watch will eventually run down. And unless you rewind that watch, it's going to run down. The second law of thermodynamics says that you start with energy and then as the energy is used, it is dissipated and eventually the universe is going to run down and die. Evolution says the exact opposite. Psalm 102 to me speaks to this. Psalm 102 verses 25 through 27. It says, of old, you, God, laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens were the work of your hands. But guess what? They will perish. God made the universe to decay. You're going to see some things as we go through this. And I'm sure that Dr. Avin has talked about this. I think he's given some sermons on this as well. But the earth is in a state of decay. The earth is not in a state of evolving to a higher species. It is decaying. They will perish, but you, God, will endure. They, the universe, will grow old like a garment. Like a cloak, you will change them, and they will be changed. But you are the same, and your years have no end. This, to me, speaks to the second law of thermodynamics. God created the universe with the laws of thermodynamics in place to where it is going to decay, and it is going to wind down. Our belief tells us that Almighty God created the earth and sustains it. It also reminds us that it couldn't have evolved from lesser forms into greater forms. I actually want to show you some experiments on that. We would say that an all-knowing God created not only the universe, but the laws of thermodynamics to prove that he exists. I think the laws of thermodynamics prove that evolution can't exist because things are running down. Given enough time, the physical creation would not evolve into a higher species, but it would eventually collapse. We'll give you a quote here. This is from Jeremy Walter. He's a PhD in mechanical engineering. He's one of the 50 scientists that think that God actually created the earth. He says, the rule of history is not of continual creation, but one of extinction. As species, as specific creatures become unable to survive the decay of the earth's ecosystem and are eliminated from the planet forever. He sees a decaying earth, not an earth that is getting better. Jeremiah 12:4 says the same thing. How long will the land mourn and the herbs of the field wither? The beasts and the birds are consumed because of the wickedness of those that dwell there. Humanity has not treated this earth right. It hasn't. We're eventually going to get to the place where we can't support life on this earth anymore. In fact, if you saw it, Stephen Hawking, who's a great scientist, and he has come out with some theories lately. I want to read a quote from him. Professor Stephen Hawking says this: "I think that the human species will have to populate a new planet within 100 years if it is to survive. With climate change, overdue asteroid strikes, epidemics, and population growth, our planet is increasingly precarious. Even science itself would tell you we are about to obliterate ourselves off this planet. God did not create this planet or this universe to live forever. He created it in a state of decay." Romans 8 tells us that, and we'll get to that in just a little while. In fact, this is my next slide. Let me go to it now. Romans 8, verse 19. "The creation is waiting for the return of Jesus Christ." Why? Because, verse 20, "the creation was subjected to frustration." It's dying. If God did not come back and fix this, our earth would eventually collapse into the sun. It's just not sustainable. And he created it like that. But it's not that it was frustrated by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it. God created it in a state of decay for a reason. And we're going to talk about that reason as we get toward the end. "The creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. Without the return of Jesus Christ, this world is doomed," just like Stephen Hawking says. Now, who knows whether it would be 100 years or, as most scientists would say, billions and billions of years. It eventually is going to come to an end. For a person who feels that given enough time, things can evolve into greater and greater things, I would give you this quote. This is one of the more humorous quotes. "Whoever feels that mutations over billions of years can account for the progression of complex life is like a merchant that knows he's losing money on every sales but feels he can make up for it in volume." What does that mean? I can make something for a dollar, but I can only sell it for 99 cents. What does that mean? Every time I sell one, I'm losing a penny. But if I just sell millions and millions of them, maybe I can make money. No, that's not how the universe works. The universe is dying. Given millions and millions and billions and millions and billions of years, you're just making the matter worse, not better. And again, we'll show you some examples of that. I want to talk about just one idea behind this. Something that the Bible would tell you, something that science will show you. Both science and religion would agree on this. Let's talk about families for a moment. We know that Adam and Eve's children would have married their brothers and their sisters. There were no other human beings on earth at the time. When Adam had Seth and Enos and Abel and all of that, they would have had to have married their brothers and sisters. There were no other humans. And you know what? At that time, it was okay. Let's go down to Abraham. Who did Abraham marry? Who was Sarah? His half-sister. Can you imagine doing that today? At the time of Abraham, the genetic structure of humans was such that you could marry your half-sisters. At the time of Adam and Eve, they could genetically were perfect as God created them, but God created Romans 8, what does it say? He created the universe in a state of decay. Now, you may think that you're all that, but in comparison to Adam, who lived 900 some odd years, you are genetically flawed compared to the way God created humanity. But he created humanity with the ability to decay on purpose. It shows, and that's what we're going to come back to that, it shows that God is the creator, because everything else, given enough time, is going to decay. So here's Adam and Eve. The sin of Adam and Eve comes in and the physical creation starts to decay. What did God say before they sinned? They could live forever. But when they sinned, second law of thermodynamics is going to take over. You're going downhill. So now we can't even marry a close relative. We can't even marry a third cousin. I think we can marry a third cousin. You can't marry a first or second cousin now. Why? Because the opportunity to, and they call it inbreeding. If you think of inbreeding, Adam and Eve's children married their brothers and sisters. We today would call that inbreeding, but it was okay then because they were genetically perfect. I want to give you an example of marrying a close relative causing a defect. This is from Wikipedia on royalty and nobility. One of the most famous examples of a genetic trait that is aggravated by intermarriage occurred in the House of Habsburg. You've heard of the Habsburg dynasty. They did not want their people marrying outside of their family because they were nobility and everybody else was the common people. And so in order to keep the line pure, they married their brothers and sisters, they married their first cousins to try and keep the line pure. What happened? As a result, the Habsburg jaw, or sometimes called the Habsburg lip, occurred. Typical for many Habsburg relatives, over a period of 600 years, the condition progressed through which the generations to the point that the last of the Spanish Habsburgs, Charles II of Spain, couldn't even properly chew his food. It changed the structure. Marrying within, so he had a genetic flaw, or early on, the dad had a genetic flaw, married his sister who had the same genetic flaw. They had kids. It exacerbated the genetic flaw to the point where, toward the end of the Habsburg dynasties, they couldn't even chew their food properly. They had to be given more mush-like food to eat. You can't marry a close relative now because our DNA is degrading. That is the second law of thermodynamics. This world needs the return of Jesus Christ to set it back on track. Otherwise, it's going to collapse. Evolution would tell you the exact opposite. Here's another one, biodiversity. This is a very interesting field. Biodiversity says that the ecosystem is made up of millions of species that are all interdependent on each other. And when one species is down, another species comes to their aid. I'll give you an example of this. When we breathe, what do we breathe in? Oxygen. When we expel, what do we breathe out? Carbon dioxide. What do trees breathe? Carbon dioxide. What do they expel? Oxygen. If you didn't have something producing carbon dioxide and something producing oxygen at the same time, humans couldn't live and neither could trees. You needed them both. You needed the ability to have oxygen production and carbon dioxide production at the same time or you couldn't have it. It's a very simple example. I'll give you some more complex ones as we go. But this is an example of what an interdependence is between species. Parts of interdependent systems can't exist without the other. They had to come in existence at the same time. How could multiple organisms have once lived independently of services that they now require? I want to give you an example of this, and then we'll talk about this in a more complex setting. DNA, which is what we're made out of, RNA, and proteins, all three have to exist at the same time in order for them to be able to function. If you did not have proteins, DNA would fall apart. But if you didn't have DNA, you couldn't produce proteins. They had to all come into being at the exact same time, or they couldn't exist. An example of this would be a cell. A cell has a wall lining that protects it. But the wall lining is produced by the proteins in the cell. If you didn't have the proteins, you couldn't produce the wall. If you didn't have the wall, the proteins would die. But if you didn't have the proteins, you wouldn't have a wall. So you had to have the protein in the cell and the wall of the cell that happened at the same time in order for a cell to exist. You can't evolve something bit by bit by bit where you get the proteins, but you don't have the ability to protect it. It all has to come together. These complex systems have to all be in place at the same time. Many parts are needed for life, and they couldn't sit idly waiting for the other parts to evolve because the existing ones would deteriorate. Like I say, you couldn't evolve a protein without having a way to protect the protein, the wall of the cell. I want to read something interesting, and I want you to look at this very carefully because this is a book by Richard Dawkins. It's called The Blind Watchmaker, and if you look at the subtitle, Why the Evidence of Evolution Reveals a Universe Without Design. This is one of his famous quotes. Given an immense universe and billions of years, the improbable becomes probable. But I want you to look at that quote really closely. What is he saying? Given enough time, the improbable becomes a fact? What word did he use? The improbable becomes possible, right? It's his theory. It's his belief system. I believe with enough time that this could evolve into something more complex. But if you look at his words himself, he's not saying that it's a fact. He's saying that it's probable. Let's go through and let's talk about this. I want to give you one example. This is a math thing. If you are really into math, you're going to like this. If you're not, you will at least find it humorous. This is using math to try and prove or disprove evolution. So I'm going to introduce a friend of mine. His name is Mr. Bones. And we're going to use him as an example today. Mr. Bones, we're going to try and see whether Mr. Bones could come into being. So as we look at this, here's some things that I want to talk about. We're going to do some math. What are the chances that a human skeleton could come together in the right order? Okay? I'm going to give you some assumptions. Typical human skeleton has 206 bones. Right? You got the radius and the ulna and the femur and the phalanges and the skull and the mandible and the various things. 206 typical bones in a human. I'm going to give you that the bones already exist, right? We're not even going to talk about the fact of how do you create a bone. The bones are already there. There are 206 bones, and they're in a box, and here you go, Mr. Evolutionist. What are you going to do with this? The forces to bring the bones together already exist. They're in a box. How do they, like, pop out of the box and one kind of sticks to the other? I'm going to even give you that. The force already exists. And I'm not even concerned with the right position. You might have the femur backwards or, you know, the head attached to the arm bone or something like that. What are the chances that 206 bones could come into existence and form a complete skeleton? And we're going to do one new combination every second. So every second we're going to redo these 206 bones. Okay, no, I got the head on the phalange. That didn't work. No, I've got the ulna connected to the femur. That doesn't work. So you're rearranging it to try and get these 206 bones in the right sequence, and you're going to do it once a second. So here's Mr. Bones, and he's praying that this is going to happen because he really wants to come into being. So the possible combination, you've got, and you can see it up here at the top, you've got 206 bones or 206 factorial, which means there are 10 to the 388th possible combinations of bones. That's 10 with 388 zeros after it. That's how many combinations there are possible out of 206 bones. Okay? If the universe is 13.7 billion years old, and I'm going to even give you 20 billion. Let's say that science is wrong and it's really 20 billion. If the universe is 20 billion years old, there are 10 to the 18th seconds in 20 billion years. You have 10.18 seconds, 10 to the 18th seconds. So do the math. With one new combination tried every second, the probability of these bones coming into the correct order would be 10 to the 388th minus 10 to the 18th, or 10 to the 370th. Just having the bones come into the right order would not be expected to occur once in 411 billion years, and yet the entire universe was supposed to have evolved 13.7 billion years ago. I'm sorry, you call me a religious fanatic if you want to, but the math doesn't add up. I've given you the bones. I didn't talk about how the forces would come into being. I don't even care about the position of the bones, but if you do the math, there is no possible way that this is going to happen. Now, let's not think of bones for a minute. Let's say that there are 206 atoms that are trying to form into a human cell. The same math would apply. Even if the atoms already existed and they tried to form into one human cell, the chance that one human cell with 206 atoms would come into being would take over 400 billion years, but the Earth is only 4.5 billion, and the universe supposedly is only 13.7. We would not expect them to be able to come together. But here's the problem. One cell doesn't contain 206 atoms. It contains 100 trillion atoms. The math doesn't add up. There is no possible way in 13.7 billion years that you could even get one cell to evolve. It cannot. The math just cannot happen. So can I prove that? No. Why? Because I can't sit down and scientifically put a bunch of atoms together and see if they would come together. But I'm telling you, it's awful improbable. And again, you can call me a religious nut, but here I am. So poor Mr. Bones, he's sitting on Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species. For all practical purposes, it is impossible for the correct position of only 206 parts to come together simultaneously by chance. Add to the fact that the average human has about 75 trillion cells, which also have to add to line up correctly. There's just no way. There's just no way that this is going to come together. Now, here's something else that I want to show you here. And I just think this is important. Not that I'm trying to poke fun at people, because religion can do this too. But there was, this is Carlsbad Cavern on the left-hand side. There was in the Arizona Highway Magazine, January of 1983, page 10 and 11. You actually can go back. I actually looked this up to make sure that this wasn't fake news. In the Carlsbad area, native and cave specialist with the U.S. Geologic Service, Jerry Trout, said, from 1924 to 1988, there was a visitor sign above the entrance of Carlsbad Caverns that said that the caverns were 260 million years old. In 1988, the sign was changed to read that the cavern was 7 to 10 million years old. Then for a while, the sign read it was 2 million years old, and now the sign is gone. All right, why? Because after studying the caves for a number of years, they realized that stalactites and stalagmites, they can grow several feet in a matter of a year. And yet they assumed that a stalactite would take millions and millions of years to grow an inch, and therefore you're drawing a conclusion from a premise. You're not supposed to do that. Circular reasoning. So just because something is said to you as a fact, and you'll hear it, kids, you when you're in school, you'll hear as a fact, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. That's today's theory. Tomorrow's theory may be something totally different. But it will be presented to you as fact. But remember, religion can do the same thing. The Earth is only 6,000 years old, and God made it to look old. That is just as wrong as stating a scientific fact that is, in fact, an opinion. That's something that we need to know. Here's another example of this. This is Piltdown Man. Anybody ever heard of this famous guy? This is really, to me, this is funny and sad at the same time. This is, in 2017, we would call this fake news. Let's go back and look at it. In 1912, Charles Dawson discovered the first of two skulls in a quarry in Sussex, England, called Piltdown. They were doing excavations. And apparently, these two skulls were of a primitive hominoid, an ancestor of man. Piltdown Man was a success, was a sensation. He was the missing link. And as a result, based on the bones that were found in this quarry, they came up with this clay sculpture of what they thought it would look like. You know, this is the missing link. Here's the problem. In 1953, some of the people that were in the Piltdown quarry admitted that it was a fraud. They had taken bones that had been collected at different places and buried them in the quarry so that they would be found, and that this whole, the idea of, there was no missing link. They've never found it, but they needed one. So what they did was they took a skull from the medieval human years, about 620 years old, a second skull, about the same age, an orangutan jaw. Why would they want an orangutan jaw? Because they want a human to look like a monkey. So you got the human skull, but the orangutan jaw. They had an elephant molar so that his teeth would look big, like you know how like a lion or whatever would have a big teeth. So probably our ancient ape ancestors would had to have had bigger teeth. A hippopotamus tooth and a canine tooth, all in the same time. Falsely buried them in here so that we could come up with this missing link. Again, in reality, I will tell you that a lot of things that are presented as absolute fact may not be fact. So when they're presented that way, guys and gals in school, recognize the fact that they are espousing their belief as a fact. Now, can I do that here? Do I stand up here and say, I am absolutely convinced that God created the earth? That's an absolute fact, and I will say that, and I believe that from the bottom of my heart. But, and it's one of the last slides here, I go back to Hebrews 11, verse 3. It is by faith that I believe that God created the earth. All right, let's keep going. Kind of go through the last part of this now. I've already been over an hour. I wanted to just talk a little bit about this earth that we live on and how lucky we are that we have a God that is strong enough to be able to create something. We have a perfect earth. I'll go through a few of these, not all of them. We're the right distance from a star. It's the right size star. We have stable planets. We have Jupiter out there. That's important. We're in the right kind of galaxy. We've got a big moon. The earth is tilted. If you go through all of these things, if you didn't have even one of these things, the earth could not exist. Humans could not exist on the earth. If you take one of those things away, you take a liquid ocean away, there's no humans. You take a large moon, if we didn't have the moon that's the size that ours is, the earth wouldn't exist. People could not have been created and exist on this earth. Let's go through a few of them. The habitable zone, one astronomical unit is the distance from the sun to the earth. The earth has to be 0.95 to 1.15 in this little sliver, or it would either be too hot or too cold. Our closest neighbors, Venus, is closer to the sun. It is the closest, by the way, planet to our size, but it is so close to the sun outside of the habitable zone that it actually glows. It's many several thousands of degrees at the surface. Mars, who is our next closest neighbor out, is not in the habitable zone, frozen several miles down. It just, you can't have something outside of this habitable zone. Any closer to the Earth, any closer and the Earth would get locked into a synchronous orbit. I don't know if you know what that means or not, but let's say that this is the sun and this is the Earth. The Earth right now is rotating like this, right? Once every 24 hours. If we were too close to the sun, it would stop rotating, and we would still go around the sun, but the same side would always be centered on the sun. So one side of the Earth would be thousands of degrees hot, and the other side would be thousands of degrees below zero, right? We have to be in the right area for the Earth to be able to continue to turn. Our own moon is a good example of that. We always see the same side of the moon. The moon is locked with the same side facing, you call it the dark side of the moon, right? If any of you Pink Floyd fans. The reason is because the moon is locked where we are always seeing one side. If the moon were a different size or a different space away from the Earth, it could rotate, but it can't right now. So our moon, even though it's in the habitable zone, is not habitable, doesn't have an atmosphere because it isn't the perfect Earth like God gave us. And yet without the moon, well, let's go to the sun first. The current temperature of the sun emits less than 10% UV light. If it were any hotter, it would fry us. If it were any less, we wouldn't have the energy that we need to be able to produce photosynthesis. It gives just the right amount of radiation for us to be able to survive. 95% of the suns in our galaxy are less massive than ours, which means the habitable zone would be less and it wouldn't be producing the right amount of energy. We have a perfect sun to work with a perfect Earth. Without those two, it wouldn't happen. Look at the moon. We need the tides to stir the elements. We have a complex tidal activity because we have a moon that is in the perfect size. Look at some of the other ones. You look at Mars and other planets. They have moons, but the moons are very small. Those moons don't produce tidal effects. Without the moon being where it is, without the moon being the size that it is, the Earth's rotation would change. We would, again, probably become tidally locked. The moon has to be at the exact size as it is, or life couldn't exist on this Earth. So we have a perfect Earth, we have a perfect sun, we have a perfect moon. You look at the Earth itself, we are the only planet with plate tectonics. Without plate tectonics, we couldn't renew the Earth. Because of plate tectonics, we have biodiversity, we have mountain ranges. The changing sea level helps keep our carbon dioxide in check. Did you know that the Earth is the one planet that creates its own magnetic field? When you look at the Earth, you don't realize this, but there is a north and a south pole. That is unique to the planets in our solar system. We have a north and a south pole because we have a liquid core and it's turning, and that generates electricity. You know, you look at the northern lights and you think how pretty that is. Do you know what the northern lights are? Harmful radiation that is coming into the Earth's atmosphere gets trapped and sucked down to the poles, and it's like a vacuum cleaner that's taking away harmful radiation from this Earth. We look at it as beauty. God created that as a way to keep the Earth pure from contaminants that would otherwise destroy life on this Earth. We have this magnetic field that other planets don't have. We look at the solar system. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune are these large gas giants that are out there. They act like vacuum cleaners. Do you ever remember the Shoemaker-Levy comet? Some of you may be too young to remember that. There was a guy that was looking at this huge comet that was coming into to our solar system and thought, oh, boy, if this solar system came to Earth, this is big enough that it would wipe Earth out. And then a couple of years into his study, he realized this is being attracted toward Jupiter. And sure enough, Jupiter acted like this big vacuum cleaner and sucked in this huge comet that, for the size of Jupiter, which is 318 times the size of the Earth, it was just a blip on the radar. But if it had come all the way through and hit Earth. So we've got all of these massive planets out there that keep the Earth protected. All of those planets, like Jupiter, like Saturn, are in stable orbits. You know, you think of an orbit being round like this. What if Jupiter were like this? You know, every once in a while it would come too close to the Earth and it would pull us out of our orbit. We have a perfect solar system. We have a perfect Earth, a perfect moon, a perfect sun. That is, to me, examples of a creator God. And I want to show you, I only have a couple of slides left. I want to show you this quote from Albert Einstein. This was written in 1929. This is a scientist. This is someone who's smarter than a lot of the people that might be teaching you ninth grade physics, like my ninth grade physics teacher was. This is a quote from him. "We are in a position of a little child entering a huge library filled with books on many different languages. The child knows someone must have written those books, but it doesn't know how. It doesn't understand the language in which they were written. The child only dimly suspects that a mysterious order in the arrangement of the books, but doesn't know what it is. That, it seems to me, is the attitude of even the most intelligent being toward God. We see a universe marvelously arranged and obeying certain laws, but we are only dimly aware of or understand those laws. Our limited minds cannot grasp the mysterious force that moves the constellations." Scientists will try and tell you that it evolved and it evolved without a God. There are a number of scientists that you could also quote saying, no, even the most noted scientists understand that there had to have been a creative force that brought this into place and is keeping it in a constant state of usefulness, even though it is starting to decay. Let's go back to Romans 1:20. We read this earlier. I want to read it again. "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes can clearly be seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." When you look at all of the things that we've got, a perfect Earth and a perfect solar system and a perfect galaxy, you've got perfect laws that govern our existence, laws like the laws of thermodynamics that, to me, disprove evolution. Biodiversity, millions of things had to come into being at the exact same time in a creative moment in order for even a protein to exist. Trees that extend through hundreds of thousands of years of geologic time. To me, God has given us all of these hints, all of these clues that he does exist. Again, we can look at the creation. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes can be seen by the things that he made. When you look at the perfection of the universe, when you look at the perfection of the laws of physics, that speaks of a creator. That doesn't speak of an evolution. The things which we see give us faith in the things that we can't see. And yet in the end, Hebrews 11, verse 3, I told you I'd come back to this. It is by faith that we understand the worlds were created by the word of God. You cannot use the Bible as a science textbook. It's not. You cannot use the science to try and prove how many years old the earth is. That wasn't why it was written. The manual in your car will tell you how to change the oil, but it won't tell you what year the piston was forged. That's not what the book is for. The book is a manual to help you understand how to live. But in the end, it is by faith that we believe in the word of God. I want to end as a last slide with something that the psalmist said. Psalm chapter 8, verses 3-5. This is what David said. And if you've never done this, and for those that go to campus, you know, if you go to Camp Carter and it's very dark out there, you can go outside and you can see some amazing night sky. "When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visited him? For you have made, or you have created him a little lower than the angels, and you have crowned him with glory and with honor." We've been put here in a perfect world, in a perfect solar system, in a perfect universe with perfect laws for a period of time to be able to see the great magnitude of God and the plan that he has to unfold. So when I look at the creation of this world, when I look at what science will try, young people, to foister on you as an absolute fact, I want you to remember, their fact is really their opinion. Their fact is their belief. And your belief is just as viable as their belief. And in fact, when you look at even what they have in the scientific community, you can easily disprove many of the things that they come up with as fact. So don't apologize for your apology. Understand what it means to know that God exists through faith by looking at the things that he's created.